Okay, thanks. It was then that I noticed that in the 4 minutes I'd been downstairs, Emily had managed to switch her faded jeans to leather pants and her own funky sneakers to open-toe stilettos. She'd also cleaned up the entire office suite, sweeping the contents of both our desks into drawers and stashing all of the incoming gifts that hadn't yet been transferred to Miranda's apartment in the closet. She had slicked on a fresh coat of lip gloss and had added some color to her cheeks and was presently motioning for me to get moving. I grabbed the bag of newspapers and shook them out in a pile on the light box in her office, a sort of underlit table where Emily and Miranda would stand for hours on end and examine film that had come in from photo shoots. But it was also where she liked her papers arranged, and once again, I consulted my legal pad for the correct order. First, the New York Times, followed by the Wall Street Journal, and then the Washington Post. And on the order went in a pattern I couldn't distinguish, each placed slightly on top of the one before it until they fanned out across the table in formation. Women's Wear Daily was the single exception. This was to be placed in the middle of her desk.
"She's here. Andrea, come out here. She's on her way up," I heard Emily hiss from the outer area. "Yuri just called to tell me he just dropped her off."
I put WWD on her desk, placed the Pellegrino on a corner of her desk on a linen napkin, which side, I couldn't remember which side it was supposed to go on, and darted from the office, taking one last look around to ensure that everything was in order. Jeffy, one of the fashion assistants who helped organize the fashion closet, tossed me a shoebox with a rubber band around it and bolted. I pulled it open immediately. Inside were a pair of Jimmy Choo heels, with straps made of camel hair going every which way, and buckles nestled in the middle of it all, probably worth around $800. Shit, I had to get these on. I yanked off my sneakers and my now sweaty socks and tossed them under my desk. The right one went on rather easily, but I couldn't work my stubby fingernail to free the buckle on the left one until... there! I pried it open and thrust my left foot into it, watching the straps bite into the already swollen flesh. In another few seconds, I had it buckled and was returning to an upright sitting position just as Miranda walked in. Frozen. I was absolutely frozen in mid-motion, my mind working fast enough to understand how ridiculous I must look, but not quite fast enough to move. She noticed me immediately, probably because she was expecting Emily to still be sitting at her old desk, and walked over. She leaned on the counter that ran over my desk, leaned over it and even closer to me until she was able to see my entire body as I sat immobilized in the chair. Her bright blue eyes moved up and down, side to side, all over my white button-down, my red corduroy Gap miniskirt, my now buckled camel hair Jimmy Choo sandals. I felt her examine every inch of me, skin and hair and clothes, her eyes moving so quickly but her face remaining frozen. She leaned closer still, until her face was only a foot from mine, and I could smell the fantastic aroma of salon shampoo and expensive perfume, so close that I could see the very fine lines around her mouth and eyes that were invisible from a more comfortable distance. But I couldn't look too long at her face, because she was intently examining mine. There wasn't the slightest indication that she recognized that A, we had in fact met before, B, I was her new employee, or C, I was not Emily.
"Hello, Miss Priestley,"
I squeaked impulsively, even though somewhere in the back of my head I knew that she hadn't uttered a word yet, but the tension was unbearable, and I couldn't help but barrel forward.
"I'm so excited to be working for you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to..."
"Shut up, just shut your stupid mouth. Talk about no dignity." She walked away, finished looking me up and down, pushed backward off the counter, and just walked away while I was stuttering mid-sentence. I could feel heat coming off my face, a flush of confusion and pain and humiliation all wrapped into one, and it didn't help that I could feel Emily glaring at me. I pulled my hot face upward and confirmed that Emily was indeed glaring at me.
"Is the bulletin updated?" Miranda asked no one in particular as she walked into her office and, I noticed happily, directly to the light table where I'd arranged her papers. Yes, Miranda, here it is, Emily said obsequiously, racing in behind her and handing her the clipboard where we kept all of Miranda's messages typed as they come in. I sat quietly, watching Miranda move deliberately around her office in the picture frames that hung on her wall. If I looked at the glass instead of at the photos themselves, I could see her reflection. Emily immediately busied herself at her desk, and silence prevailed. Do we never get to talk to each other or anyone else if she's in the office, I wondered. I wrote a quick email to Emily, asking her as much, which I saw her receive and read. Her answer came back right away.
You got it, she wrote. And if you and I have to talk, we whisper. Otherwise, no talking. And don't ever speak to her unless she speaks to you. And do not ever call her Ms. Priestley. It's Miranda, got it?
I felt again as if I'd been slapped, but I looked up and nodded. And it was then I noticed the coat. It was right there. A great big pile of fabulous-looking fur, all bunched up on the end of my desk, with one arm dangling off the edge. I looked at Emily. She rolled her eyes, waved her hand toward the closet, and mouthed,
"Hang it up!"
It was as heavy as a wet-down comforter coming out of the washing machine, and I needed both hands to keep it from dragging on the floor, but I gingerly hung it on one of the silk hangers and gently, quietly, closed the doors. I hadn't even sat back down when Miranda appeared next to me, and this time her eyes were free to roam over my entire body. Impossible as it seemed, I could feel each body part ignite as she eyed it. But I was frozen, unable to dive back to my chair. Just as my hair was about to catch fire, those relentless blue eyes finally stopped on mine. "I'd like my coat," she said quietly, looking directly at me. And I wondered if she wondered who I was, or if she didn't notice or care that there was a relative stranger posing as her assistant. There wasn't so much as a glimmer of recognition, even though my interview with her had taken place a few weeks earlier. "Surely," I managed, and moved toward the closet again, which was an awkward maneuver because she was currently standing between it and me. I turned my body sideways to keep from bumping into her, and tried to slide myself past her, reaching to pull open the door I had just shut. She didn't move a single inch to let me pass, and I could feel that the eyes had continued their roving. Finally, blessedly, my hands closed around the fur, and I pulled it carefully to freedom. I wanted to throw it at her and see if she'd catch it, but I restrained myself at the last second and held it open as a gentleman would for a lady. She shrugged into it with one graceful motion and picked up her cell phone, the only item she had brought with her to the office. "I'd like the book tonight, Emily," she said as she walked confidently out of the office, probably not even noticing that a cluster of three women standing in the hall outside the suite scattered immediately upon seeing her, chins to their chests.
"Yes, Miranda, I'll have Andrea bring it up."
That was that. She left. And the visit that had inspired office-wide panic, frenzied preparations, even makeup and wardrobe adjustments, had lasted just under 4 minutes and had taken place, as far as my inexperienced eyes could see, for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Chapter 8.
"Don't look now," James said, his mouth as immobile as a ventriloquist's. "But I see Reese Witherspoon at 3 o'clock.
I swiveled immediately as he cringed in embarrassment, and sure enough, there she was, sipping a glass of champagne and throwing her head back in laughter. I didn't want to be impressed, but I couldn't help it. She was one of my favorite actresses.
"James, darling, I'm so glad you could make it to my little party," quipped a thin, beautiful man who came up behind us. "And who do we have here?"
They kissed.
"Marshall Madden, color guru, this is Andrea Sachs. Andrea is actually..."
"Miranda's new assistant," Marshall finished, smiling at me. "I've heard all about you, little one. Welcome to the family. I do hope you'll come visit me. I promise that together we can, smooth over your look.
He ran his hand lovingly over my scalp and picked up the ends of my hair, which he immediately held up against the roots.
Yes, just a touch of something honey-colored, and you'll be the next supermodel. Get my number from James, okay, sweetie, and come see me any time you get a minute. Probably easier said than done, he sang as he floated toward Reese.
James sighed and looked on wistfully.
He's a master, he breathed. Simply the best, the ultimate, a man among boys, to say the least, and gorgeous.
A man among boys. Funny. Whenever anyone had used that phrase before, I'd always pictured Shaquille O'Neal making a move toward the hoop against the small power forward, not a colorist.
He's definitely gorgeous, I'll agree with you there. Have you ever dated him?
It seemed like the perfect match. The associate beauty editor of Runway, dating the most sought-after colorist in the free world.
I wish. He's been with the same guy for 4 years now, do you believe it? 4 years! Since when are hot gay men allowed to be monogamous? It's just not fair.
Hey, I hear ya. Since when are hot straight men allowed to be monogamous? Well, unless they're being monogamous with me, that is. I took a long drag from my cigarette and blew out a near-perfect smoke ring.
So admit it, Andy. Tell me you're glad you came tonight. Tell me this isn't the greatest party ever,
he said, smiling. I grudgingly decided to go with James after Alex had canceled, mostly because he wouldn't leave me alone. It seemed utterly impossible that a single interesting thing would transpire at a party for a book about highlights, but I had to admit that I'd been surprised. When Johnny Depp had come over to say hi to James, I was shocked that he not only seemed to have a full command of the English language, but he had even managed a few funny jokes. And it was intensely gratifying to see that Giselle, the ittest it girl of all current it girls, was downright short. Of course, it would have been even nicer to discover that she was secretly squat, too, or had a major acne problem that had all been airbrushed out in her gorgeous cover shoots. But I'd settle for short. All in all, it hadn't been a bad hour and a half so far.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, I said, leaning toward him to catch a glimpse of a great-looking guy who appeared to be sulking in the corner near the book table.
But it hasn't been quite as disgusting as I'd imagined, and besides, I'm up for anything after the day I've had. After Miranda had made her rather abrupt departure, after her rather abrupt arrival, Emily informed me that that night would be the first time I would have to bring the book to Miranda's apartment. The book was a large, wire-bound collection of pages as big as a phone book, in which each current issue of Runway was mocked up and laid out. She explained that no substantial work could get done each day until after Miranda left, because all of the art people and editorial people spent all day long consulting with her, and she changed her mind every hour. Therefore, when Miranda left, around 5 each day, to spend some time with the twins, the real day's work would begin. The art department would craft their new layout and input any new photos that had come in, and editorial would tweak and print any copy that had finally, gotten Miranda's approval, a giant looping MP scrawled across the entire first page. Every editor would send all the day's new changes to the art assistant, who, hours after nearly everyone else had left, would run the images and layouts and words through a small machine that waxed the backs of the pages and pressed them into their appropriate pages in the book. It was then my job to take the book up to Miranda's apartment whenever it was finished, anywhere in the 8 to 11 p.m. range, depending on where in the production process we were, at which point she'd mark it all up. She'd bring it back the next day, and the entire staff would go through the whole thing again. When Emily overheard me tell James that I'd go to the party with him after all, she jumped right in.
You know you can't go anywhere until the book's finished, right?
I stared. James looked as though he might tackle her.
Yeah, I have to say this is the part of your job I'm most happy to be done with. It can get really, really late sometimes. But Miranda needs to see it every single night, you know. She works from home. Anyway, I'll wait with you tonight and show you how to do it, but then, you're on your own.
Okay, thanks. Any idea when it'll be finished tonight?
Nope. Changes every night. You'd really have to ask the art department.
The book was finally ready, on the earlier side, at 8:30, and after I'd retrieved it from an exhausted-looking art assistant, Emily and I walked down to 59th Street together. Emily was holding an armful of freshly dry-cleaned clothes on hangers encased in plastic, and she explained to me that dry-cleaning always accompanied the book. Miranda would bring her dirty clothes to the office, where, as my luck would have it, it was my job to call the cleaners and let them know we had a pickup. They would send someone to the Elias Clark building immediately, pick up the clothes, and return them in perfect condition a day later. We stored them in our office closet until we could either hand them off to Yuri or take them to her apartment ourselves. My job was getting more intellectually stimulating by the minute.
"Hey, Rich,"
Emily called brightly, fakely, to the pipe-chomping dispatcher I'd met my first day.
"This is Andrea. She'll be taking the book every night, so make sure she gets a good car, okay?"
"Will do, Red."
He pulled the pipe out of his mouth and motioned toward me.
"I'll take good care of Blondie over here."
"Great. Oh, and can you have another car follow us to Miranda's? Andrea and I are going separate places after we drop off the book."
Two massive town cars pulled up just at that moment, and the mammoth driver in the first car barreled out of the front seat and opened the back door for us. Emily climbed in first, immediately whipped out her cell phone, and called out,
"Miranda Priestley's apartment, please."
He nodded and threw the car in gear, and we were off.
"Is it always the same driver?" I asked, wondering how he knew where to go.
She motioned for me to be quiet as she left a message for her roommate. She then said,
"No. But there are only so many drivers who work for the company. I've had all of them at least 20 times, so they know their way by now."
She went back to her dialing. I looked behind us and saw the second empty town car carefully mimicking our turns and stops. We pulled up in front of a typical Fifth Avenue doorman building. Immaculate sidewalk, well-kept balconies, and what looked like a gorgeous, warmly lit lobby. A man in a tuxedo and hat immediately came to the car and opened the door for us, and Emily got out. I wondered why we weren't just gonna leave the book and the clothes with him. As far as I understood, and it wasn't a lot, especially when it came to this strange city, that's what doormen were for, as in, that's their job. But Emily pulled a leather Louis Vuitton keychain from her Gucci logo tote and handed it to me.
"I'll wait here. You take the stuff up to her apartment, Penthouse A. Just open her door and leave the book on the table in the foyer and hang the clothes on the hooks by the closet. Not in the closet, by the closet. And then just leave. Whatever you do, don't knock or ring the doorbell. She doesn't like to be disturbed. Just let yourself in and out and be quiet."
She handed me the tangle of wire hangers and plastic and opened her cell phone again. "All right, I can handle this. Why so much drama for a book and some pants?" The elevator man smiled kindly at me and silently pressed the PH button after turning a key. He looked like a battered wife, dejected and sad, as though he couldn't fight any longer and had just made peace with his unhappiness. "I'll wait here," he said softly, staring at the floor.
"You shouldn't be more than a minute."
The carpet in the hallways was a deep burgundy color, and I almost toppled over it when one of my heels got stuck in the loops. The walls were papered in a thick cream-colored fabric that had tiny cream pinstripes running the length, and there was a suede cream bench pushed against the wall. The French doors directly in front of me said PHB, but I swiveled and saw identical doors with PHA. It took every ounce of restraint not to ring the bell, but I remembered Emily's warning and slid the key in the lock. It clicked right away. And before I could fix my hair or wonder what was on the other side, I was standing in a large, airy foyer and smelling the most amazing scent of lamb chops. And there she was, delicately bringing a fork to her mouth, while two identical black-haired little girls yelled at each other across the table, and a tall, rugged-looking man with silver hair and a broad, face-encompassing nose read a newspaper.
"Mom, tell her that she can't just walk in my room and take my jeans. She won't listen to me,"
one of them pleaded of Miranda, who'd set down her fork and was taking a sip of what I knew to be Pellegrino with a lime from the left side of the table.
"Carolyn, Cassidy, enough. I simply don't want to hear it anymore. Tomas, bring out some more mint jelly,"
she called. A man I presumed to be the chef hurried into the room, holding a silver bowl on a silver serving platter. And then I realized that I'd been standing there for nearly 30 seconds, observing them all having dinner. They hadn't seen me yet, but would as soon as I moved toward the hall table. I did so gingerly, but felt them all turn to look. Just as I was about to offer some sort of greeting, I remembered making a gigantic ass out of myself at our first meeting earlier today, stammering and stumbling like an idiot, and I kept my mouth shut.
Table, table, table. There it was. Deposit book on table. And now for the clothes.
I looked around frantically for the place I was supposed to hang the dry cleaning, but I couldn't focus. The dinner table had grown silent, and I could feel them all watching me. No one said hello. It didn't seem to bother the girls that there was a perfect stranger standing in their apartment. Finally, I saw a small coat closet tucked away behind the door, and I managed to get every twisted, slippery hanger on the rod.
"Not in the closet, Emily," I heard Miranda call out, slowly, deliberately. "On the hooks that are provided for this exact occasion."
"Oh, hi there."
"Idiot, shut up. She's not looking for a response. Just do what she says."
But I couldn't help it. It was just too weird that no one had said hello or wondered who I might be or in any way acknowledged that someone had just let herself into their apartment and was prowling around. And Emily? Was she kidding? Blind? Could she really not tell that I was not the girl who'd worked for her for over a year already?
"I'm Andrea, Miranda. I'm your new assistant."
Silence. All-pervasive. Unbearable. Never-ending. Deafening. Debilitating silence. I knew I shouldn't keep talking. Knew that I was digging my own grave, but I just couldn't help myself.
Well, sorry about the confusion. I'll just put these on the hooks, like you said, and let myself out.
Stop narrating. She doesn't give a shit what you're doing. Just do it and get out.
Okay, then. Have a nice dinner. Nice meeting all of you.
I turned to leave and realized that not only was the mere act of talking ridiculous, but I was also saying stupid things. Nice to meet you? I hadn't been introduced to a single one of them.
"Emily?"
I heard just as my hand reached the doorknob.
"Emily, let this not happen tomorrow night. We're not interested in the interruption."
And the doorknob turned itself in my hand, and I was finally in the hallway. The entire thing had taken less than a minute, but I felt like I'd just swum the entire length of an Olympic-sized pool without coming up for air. I slumped onto the bench and took long, controlled breaths. That bitch. The first time she called me Emily could have been a mistake, but the second was undoubtedly deliberate. What better way to belittle and marginalize someone than to insist on calling them the wrong name after you've refused to so much as acknowledge their presence in your own home? I knew I was the lowest-ranking life form at the magazine already, as Emily hadn't yet lost an opportunity to impress upon me. But was it really so necessary for Miranda to make sure I was aware of it, too? It wouldn't have been outside the realm of reality to sit there all night and shoot mental bullets at the PHA doors, but I heard a throat clearing and looked up to find the sad little elevator man watching the floor and patiently waiting for me to join him.
"Sorry," I said as I shuffled aboard.
"No problem,"
he near whispered, intently studying the wood-paneled floor.
It'll get easier.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you...
Nothing, nothing. Here you are, miss. Have a nice evening.
The door opened to the lobby where Emily was loudly chattering on her cell phone. She clicked it closed when she saw me.
How'd it go? No problem, right?
I thought about telling her what had transpired. Wished fervently that she could be a sympathetic co-worker, that we could be a team. But I knew I'd just be setting myself up for another verbal lashing. So not interested right now.
It was totally fine. No problems at all. They were eating dinner and I just left everything exactly where you said.
Good. Well, that's what you'll do every night. Then just take the car home and you're done. Anyway, have fun at Marshall's party tonight. I'd definitely go, but I have a bikini wax appointment I just can't cancel. Do you believe they're booked for the next 2 months? And it's the middle of winter, too. It must be all the people who are going on winter vacations, right? I just can't understand why every woman in New York needs a bikini wax right now. It's just so strange, but hey, what can you do?
My head pounded to the tempo of her voice, and it seemed that no matter what I did or how I responded, I was sentenced to forever listen to her talk about bikini waxes. It may have been better to have her scream at me about interrupting Miranda's dinner.
Yeah, what can you do? Well, I'd better get going. I told James I'd meet him at 9, and it's already 10 after. See you tomorrow?
Yep, will do. Oh, just so you know, now that you're pretty much trained, you'll still get in at 7, but I don't come in until 8. Miranda knows. It's understood that the senior assistant comes in later, since she works so much harder.
I almost lunged at her throat.
So just go through the morning routine like I taught you. Call me if you have to, but you should know the drill by now. Bye.
She hopped into the back seat of the second car that was waiting in front of the building.
Bye, I trilled, a giant fake smile plastered on my face.
The driver made a move to get out of the car and open the door for me, but I told him I was fine to let myself into the back seat.
The plaza, please.
James had been waiting for me on the stairs outside, even though it couldn't have been more than 20 degrees. He'd gone home to change and looked very, very skinny in black suede pants and a white-ribbed tank top, which showed off his expertly applied midwinter bottle tan. I still looked appropriately amateurish in my Gap miniskirt.
Hey, Andy, how'd the book dropping off go?
We waited in line to check our coats, and I had immediately spotted Brad Pitt.
Oh, my God, you're joking. Brad Pitt's here?
Yeah, well, Marshall does Jennifer's hair, Natch, so she must be here also. Really, Andy, maybe next time you'll believe me when I tell you to stick with me. Let's get a drink.
The recent Johnny spottings had come back to back, and by the time 1 a.m. rolled around, I'd had 4 drinks and was happily gabbing away with a fashion assistant from Vogue. We were discussing bikini waxes. Passionately. And it didn't even bother me. Christ, I thought, as I weaved through the crowd looking for James, flashing a giant kiss-ass smile in the general direction of Jennifer Aniston when I passed by. This isn't a half-bad party. But I was tipsy, and I had to be at work in less than 6 hours, and I hadn't been home in nearly 24. So when I spotted James making out with one of the colorists from Marshall's salon, I was about to duck out when I felt a hand in the small of my back.
Hey, said the gorgeous guy I'd spotted earlier lurking in the corner.
I waited for him to realize that he'd approached the wrong girl, that I must have looked the same as his girlfriend from behind, but he just smiled even wider.
Not so talkative, are you?
Oh, and saying hey makes you articulate, I guess?
Andy, shut your mouth, I berated silently. Some absolutely beautiful man approaches you out of the blue at a party full of celebrities, and you tell him off right away?
But he didn't seem offended, and even though it didn't seem possible, his smile increased in size to an all-out grin.
Sorry, I muttered while examining my nearly empty drink. My name's Andrea. There, I think that's a much better way of beginning. I stuck out my hand and wondered what he wanted.
Actually, I like your way just fine. Name's Kristen. Pleasure to meet you, Andy.
He brushed a brown curl out of his left eye and took a swig from a bottle of Budweiser. He looked vaguely familiar, I decided, but I couldn't place him.
Bud, huh?
I asked, pointing to his hand. I didn't think they served something so lowbrow at a party like this. He laughed, a deep, hearty laugh instead of the chuckle I'd expected.
You sure do say what you think, don't you?
I must have looked mortified because he smiled again and said,
No, no, that's a good thing, and a rare thing, especially in this industry. I couldn't bring myself to drink champagne from a straw out of a mini bottle, you know? Something fairly emasculating about that. So the bartender dug one of these out of the kitchen somewhere.
Another curl push, but it fell back in his eye the moment he took his hand away. He pulled a pack of cigarettes from the pocket of his black sport coat and offered it to me. I took one and proceeded to drop it immediately, seizing the opportunity to examine him while I reached down to retrieve it. It landed a few inches from his shiny square-toed loafers that sported the irrefutable Gucci tassel, and on the way up, I noticed that his diesel jeans were the perfect parts faded, long, and wide enough at the bottom that they dragged a little behind the shiny loafers, the ends frayed from repeated interaction with the soles. A black belt, probably Gucci but thankfully not recognizable, kept the jeans riding in the perfect low spot below his waist, where he had tucked in a plain white cotton T-shirt, one that, even though it easily could have been a Hanes, was definitely an Armani or a Hugo Boss, and was put in place only to offset his beautiful complexion. His black blazer looked just as expensive and well-cut, perhaps even custom-made to fit his average size but inexplicably sexy frame, and it was his green eyes that commanded the most attention. Seafoam, I thought, remembering the old J. Crew colors we'd loved so much in high school, or perhaps just a straightforward teal. The height, the build, the whole package looked vaguely like Alex, just with a whole lot more Euro style and a whole lot less Abercrombie. Slightly cooler, slightly better looking, definitely older, right around 30, and probably much too slick. He immediately produced a flame and leaned in close to make sure my cigarette had caught.
So what brings you to a party like this, Andrea? Are you one of the lucky few who can call Marshall Madden her own?
No, I'm afraid not. At least not yet, although he wasn't all that subtle in telling me that I probably should be. I laughed, noticing for a brief moment that I was desperate to impress this stranger. I work at Runway. One of the beauty guys dragged me here.
Oh, Runway Magazine, huh? Cool place to work, if you're into S&M and that sort of thing. How do you like it?
I wasn't sure if he meant S&M or the job itself, but I considered the possibility that he got it, that he was enough of an insider to know that it wasn't exactly how it appeared to those on the outside. Perhaps I should charm him with the nightmare involved in dropping off the book earlier that night. No, no. I had no idea who this guy was. For all I knew, he also worked at Runway in some far-flung department I hadn't even seen yet, or maybe for another Elias Clark magazine. Or maybe, just maybe, he was one of those sneaky Page Six reporters that Emily had so carefully warned me against.
They just appear, she said ominously. They just appear and try to trick you into saying something juicy about Miranda or Runway. Just be aware.
Between that and the tracking ID cards, I was quite sure that Runway's surveillance put the mob to shame. The Runway paranoid turnaround was back. Yeah, I said, trying to sound casual and noncommittal. It's a strange place. I'm not so into fashion. I'd actually rather be writing, but I guess it's not a bad start. What do you do?
I'm a writer.
Oh, you are? Well, that must be nice. I hoped I didn't sound quite as condescending as I felt, but it got to be really annoying when anyone and everyone in New York anointed himself or herself a writer or actor or poet or artist. I used to write for the paper in college, I thought to myself, and hell, I even had an essay published in a monthly magazine once in high school. Did that make me a writer? What do you write?
Mostly literary fiction so far, but I'm actually working on my first historical novel.
He took another swig and swatted yet again at that pesky but adorable curl. First historical implied that there were other non-historical novels. Interesting. What's it about? He thought for a moment and then said,
It's a story told from the perspective of a young woman about what it's like to live in this country during World War II. I'm still finishing my research and transcribing interviews and things like that, but the little writing I've done so far has come along. I think...
He continued talking, but I'd already tuned him out. Holy shit. I recognized the book description immediately from a New Yorker article I just read. It seemed the entire book world was eagerly anticipating his next contribution and couldn't shut up about the realism with which he depicts his female heroine. I was standing at a party, casually chatting with Christian Collinsworth, the boy genius who'd first been published at the ripe old age of 20 from a Yale library cubicle. The critics had gone crazy over his first book, hailing it as one of the most significant literary achievements of the 20th century, and he'd followed it up with two more since then, each spending more time on the bestseller list than the one before it. The New Yorker piece had included an interview in which the author had called Christian not only a force for years to come in the book industry, but one with a hell of a look, a killer style, and enough natural charm that would ensure, in the unlikely event that his literary success did not, a lifetime of success with the ladies. Well, that's really great, I said, all of a sudden feeling too tired to be witty or funny or cute. This guy was some big-time author. What the hell did he want with me, anyway? Probably just killing time before his girlfriend finished up her $10,000-per-day modeling assignment and made her way over. And what does it matter either way, Andrea? I asked myself harshly. In case you've conveniently forgot, you do happen to have an incredibly kind and supportive and adorable boyfriend. Enough of this already. I hastily made up a story about needing to get home right away, and Christian looked amused.
You're scared of me, he stated factually, flashing me a teasing smile.
Scared of you? Why on earth would I be scared of you? Unless there's some reason I should be. I couldn't help but flirt back. He made it so easy. He reached for my elbow and deftly turned me around.
Come on, I'll put you in a cab.
And before I could say no, that I was perfectly fine to find my own way home, that it was nice to meet him, but he'd better think again if he thought he was coming home with me, I was standing on the red-carpeted steps of the plaza with him.
Need a cab, folks? The doorman asked us as we walked outside. Yes, please, one for the lady, Christian answered.
No, I have a car, right over there, I said, pointing to the strip of 58th Street in front of the Paris Theater, where all the town cars had lined up. I wasn't looking at him, but I could feel Christian smiling again. One of those smiles. He walked over to the car and opened the door, swinging his arm gallantly toward the back seat. Thank you, I said formally, not a little awkwardly, while extending my hand. It was really nice to meet you, Christian.
And you, Andrea.
He took the hand I'd intended him to shake, and instead pressed it to his lips, leaving it there just a fraction of a second longer than he should have.
I do hope we see each other again soon.
And by then, I'd somehow made it into the back seat without tripping or otherwise humiliating myself, and was concentrating on not blushing, even though I could already feel that it was too late. He slammed the door and watched as the car pulled away. It didn't seem strange this time that, even though I hadn't so much as seen the interior of a town car 2 months earlier, I had personally had one chauffeuring me around for the past 6 hours, and that even though I'd never really met anyone even remotely famous before, I'd just rubbed elbows with Hollywood celebrities and had my hand nuzzled. Yes, that was it. He'd nuzzled it. By one of the undisputed most eligible bachelors in New York City. None of that really matters, I reminded myself over and over again. It's all a part of that world, and that world is no place you want to be. It might look like fun from here, I thought, but you'd be in way over your head. But I stared at my hand anyway. trying to remember every last detail about the way he'd kissed it, and then thrust the offending hand into my bag and pulled out my phone. As I dialed Alex's number, I wondered what exactly, if anything, I would tell him. Chapter 9. It took me 12 weeks before I gorged myself on the seemingly limitless supply of designer clothes that Runway was just begging to provide for me. 12 impossibly long weeks of 14-hour workdays and never more than 5 hours of sleep at a time. 12 miserable long weeks of being looked up and down from hair to shoes each and every day and never receiving a single compliment or even merely the impression that I had passed. 12 horrifically long weeks of feeling stupid, incompetent, and all around moronic. And so I decided at the beginning of my 4th month, only 9 more to go, at Runway, to be a new woman and start dressing the part. Getting myself awake, dressed, and out the door prior to my 12-week epiphany had sapped me completely. Even I had to concede that it'd be easier to own a closet full of appropriate clothes. Until that point, putting on clothes had been the most stressful part of an already really lousy morning routine. The alarm went off so early that I couldn't bear to tell anyone what time I actually woke up, as though the mere mention of the words inflicted physical pain. Getting to work at 7 a.m. was so difficult, it bordered on funny. Sure, I'd been up and out a few times in my life by 7, perhaps sitting in an airport when I had to catch an early flight, or having to finish studying for an exam that day. But mostly, when I'd seen that hour of daylight from the outside, it was because I hadn't yet found my way to bed from the night before, and the time didn't seem so bad when a full day of sleep stretched out ahead. This was different. This was constant, unrelenting, inhuman sleep deprivation, and no matter how many times I tried to go to bed before midnight, I never could. The past 2 weeks had been particularly rough, since they were closing one of the spring issues, so I had to sit at work waiting for the book until close to 11 some nights. By the time I would drop it off and get home, it was already midnight, and I still had to eat something and crawl out of my clothes before passing out. Blaring static, the only thing I couldn't ignore, began at exactly 5:30 a.m. I would force a bare foot out from under the comforter and stretch my leg in the general direction of the alarm clock, which itself was placed strategically at the foot of my bed to force some movement, kicking aimlessly until I had made contact and the shrieking ceased. This continued steadily and predictably every 7 minutes until 6:04 a.m., at which point I would inevitably panic and spring from bed to shower. A tangle with my closet came next, usually between 6:31 and 6:37 a.m. Lily, herself not exactly fashion-conscious in her graduate student uniform, of jeans, ratty L.L. Bean sweaters, and hemp necklaces, said every time I saw her, "I still don't understand what you wear to work. It's Runway Magazine, for God's sake. Your clothes are as cute as the next girl's, Andy, but nothing you own is Runway material." I didn't tell her that for the first few months I had risen extra early with an intense determination to coax Runway looks from my very Banana Republic-heavy wardrobe. I'd stood with my microwaved coffee for nearly a half hour each morning, agonizing over boots and belts, wool and microfiber. I'd changed stockings 5 times until I finally had the right color, only to berate myself that stockings of any style or color were so not okay. The heels on my shoes were always too short, too stacked, too thick. I didn't own a single thing in cashmere. I had not yet heard of thongs, and therefore obsessed maniacally over how to banish panty lines, sometimes the focus of a coffee break critique. No matter how many times I tried them on, I couldn't bring myself to wear a tube top to work. And so, after 3 months, I surrendered. I just got too tired. Emotionally, physically, mentally, the daily wardrobe ordeal had sapped me of all energy. Until, that is, I relented on the 3-month anniversary of my first day. It was a day like any other, as I stood with my yellow I Heart Providence mug in one hand, the other hand rifling through my Abercrombie favorites. Why fight it? I asked myself. Simply wearing their clothes wouldn't necessarily mean I was a total sellout, would it? And besides, the comments on my current wardrobe were becoming more frequent and vicious, and I'd begun to wonder if my job was at risk. I looked in the full-length mirror and had to laugh. The girl in the maiden form bra, ick, and cotton jockey bikinis, double ick, was trying to look the part of runway? Ha! Not with this shit. I was working at Runway Magazine, for Christ's sake, simply putting on anything that wasn't torn, frayed, stained, or outgrown, really wasn't gonna cut it anymore. I pushed aside my generic button-downs and ferreted out the tweedy Prada skirt, black Prada turtleneck, and mid-calf-length Prada boots that Jeffy had handed me one night while I waited for the book. What's this? I'd asked, unzipping the garment bag. This, Andy, is what you should be wearing if you don't want to get fired. He smiled, but he wouldn't look me in the eye. I'm sorry? Look, I just think you should know that your look isn't really going over well with everyone around here. Now, I know this stuff gets expensive, but there's ways around that. I've got so much stuff in the closet that no one will notice if you need to, borrow some of it sometimes.
He made quote marks with his fingers around the word borrow.
And of course, you should be calling all the PR people and getting your discount card for their designers. I only get 30% off, but since you work for Miranda, I'll be surprised if they charge you for anything. There's no reason for this, gap thing you've got going on to continue.
I didn't explain that wearing Nine West instead of Manolo's or jeans they sold in Macy's Junior Department, but not anywhere on Barney's eighth floor of Couture Denim Heaven, had been my own attempt to show everyone that I wasn't seduced by all things runway. Instead, I just nodded, noticing that he looked supremely uncomfortable having to tell me that I was humiliating myself every day. I wondered who'd put him up to it. Emily? Or Miranda herself? Didn't really matter either way. Hell, I'd already survived 3 full months. If wearing a Prada turtleneck instead of one from Urban Outfitters was going to help me survive the next 9, then so be it. I decided I'd start putting together a new and improved wardrobe immediately. I finally made it outside by 6:50 a.m., actually feeling pretty damn good about the way I looked. The guy in the breakfast cart closest to my apartment even whistled, and a woman stopped me before I'd taken 10 steps and told me she had been eyeing those boots for 3 months now. I could get used to this, I thought. Everyone's got to put something on every day, and this sure felt a hell of a lot better than any of my stuff. As was now habit, I walked to the corner of 3rd Avenue and promptly hailed a cab and collapsed into the warm back seat, too tired to be thankful that I didn't have to join the commoners on the subway, and croaked, 640 Madison, quickly please. The cabbie looked at me through the rear view with a touch of sympathy, I swear, and said,
Ah, yes, Elias Clark Building.
And we squealed left onto 97th Street and made another left onto Lex, flying through the lights until 59th Street, where we headed west to Madison. After exactly 6 minutes, since there was no traffic, we came to a screeching halt in front of the tall, thin, sleek monolith that set such a fine physical example for so many of its inhabitants. The fare came to $6.40 like it did every single morning, and I handed the cabbie a $10 bill, like I did every single morning. Keep the change, I sang, feeling the same joy I did every day when I saw their shock and happiness. It's on runway. No problem there, that's for sure. It took all of a week on the job to see that accounting wasn't exactly a strong suit at Elias, not even a real priority. It was never a problem to write off $10 cab rides each and every day. Another company might wonder what gave you the right to take a cab to work in the first place. Elias Clark wondered why you had deigned to take a cab when there was a car service available. Something about jipping the company out of that extra $10 each day,
even though I don't imagine anyone was directly suffering from my overspending, made me feel a whole lot better. Some might have called it passive-aggressive rebellion. I called it getting even. I bolted from the cab, still happy to make someone else's day, and walked toward 640 Madison. Although it was named the Elias Clark Building, J.S. Bergman, one of the most prestigious banks in the city, obviously, rented half of it. We didn't share anything with them, not even an elevator bank, but it didn't stop their rich bankers and our fashion beauties from checking each other out in the lobby.
Hey, Andy. What's up? Long time no see.
The voice behind me sounded sheepish and unwilling, and I wondered why whoever it was didn't just leave me alone. I'd been mentally preparing myself to start the morning routine with Eduardo when I'd heard my name, and I turned to see Benjamin, one of Lily's many ex-boyfriends from college, slumped against the building just outside the entrance, not even seeming to notice that he was sitting on the sidewalk. He was only one of many of Lily's guys, but he'd been the first one she'd really, genuinely liked. I hadn't spoken to good old Benji, he loathed being called that, since Lily had walked in on him having sex with two girls from her a cappella singing group. Walked right into his off-campus apartment and found him sprawled out in his living room with one soprano and a contralto. Mousy girls who never did manage to look at Lily again. I tried to convince her it was just a college prank, but she didn't buy it. Cried for days, and made me promise not to tell anyone what she'd discovered. I didn't have to tell anyone, though, because he did. Bragged to anyone who would listen about how he'd nailed two singing geeks, as he'd put it, while a third one watched. He'd made it sound as though Lily had been there the entire time, agreeably perched on the couch, and watching her big bad man go about being manly. Lily had sworn to never let herself really fall for another guy, and so far, seemed to be keeping her promise. She slept with plenty of them, but she sure didn't let them stick around long enough to actually run the risk of discovering something likable about them. I looked at him again, and tried to find the old Benji in this guy's face. He had been athletic and cute, just a normal guy, but Bergman had turned him into a shell of a human. He was wearing an oversized, wrinkled suit, and looked as though he was hoping to suck crack cocaine out of his Marlboro. He seemed already overworked, even though it was only 7 o'clock, and this made me feel better, because it was payback for being an asshole to Lily, and because I wasn't the only one dragging myself to work at such an obscene hour. He was probably getting paid $150,000 a year to be so miserable, but whatever, at least I wasn't alone. Benji saluted me with his lit cigarette, glowing eerily in the still dark winter morning, and motioned for me to come over. I was nervous I'd be late, but Eduardo gave me his "don't worry, she's not here yet, you're fine" look, and I walked over to Benji. He looked bleary-eyed and hopeless. He probably thought he had a tyrannical boss. Ha! If only he knew. I wanted to laugh out loud.
"Hey, I noticed you're the only one here this early every day,"
he muttered at me while I dug around in my bag for lipstick before hitting the elevators.
"What's the deal?"
He looked so tired, so beaten down, that I felt a surge of sympathy and kindness. But then I felt my legs nearly give out from exhaustion, and I remembered the way Lily had looked when one of Benji's dumb lacrosse buddies had asked if she'd been happy to watch, or really actually wanted to join in, and I lost my cool. "Well, my deal is that I work for a rather demanding woman and I need to get here 2.5 hours before the rest of the goddamn magazine so that I'm prepared for her," I said, my tone dripping with anger and sarcasm.
"Whoa, just asking. Sorry, though. Sounds pretty bad. Which one do you work for?"
"I work for Miranda Priestley," I said, and prayed for a non-reaction. Something about having a seemingly well-educated, successful professional have no idea who Miranda was made me very, very happy. Delighted, almost. And luckily, this one didn't let me down. He shrugged and inhaled and looked at me expectantly. "She's the editor-in-chief of Runway," I lowered my voice and began with glee. "And pretty much the biggest bitch I've ever met. I mean, honestly, never met anyone like her. She's really not even human." I had a litany of complaints I would have liked to have dumped on Benji, but the runway paranoid turnaround came on full force. I became immediately nervous, almost paranoid, convinced that this unknowing, uncaring person was somehow one of Miranda's lackeys, sent to spy on me from the Observer or Page Six. I knew it was ridiculous, completely absurd. After all, I had personally known Benji for years now and was quite sure he wasn't working for Miranda in any capacity. Just not totally sure. After all, how could you be totally sure? And who knew who could be standing behind me at that very second, overhearing every one of my nasty words? Damage control was required immediately. Of course, she is the most powerful woman in fashion publishing, and you just can't get to the top of two major industries in New York City handing out candy all day long. It's understandable that she's a little tough to work for, you know? I would be too. Yeah. So, I have to run now. Good seeing you again. And I ducked away, as I often had the past few weeks when I found myself talking to someone other than Lily or Alex or my parents, and I couldn't help myself from bashing the witch.
Hey, don't feel too bad, he called after me as I headed toward the elevator bank. I've been here since last Thursday morning.
And with that, he dropped his smoldering butt and half-heartedly stamped it into the cement. Morning, Eduardo, I said, looking at him with my best, tired, pathetic eyes. I fucking hate Mondays.
Hey, buddy, don't worry. At least you beat her here this morning, he said, smiling.
He was referring, of course, to those miserable mornings when Miranda would show up at 5 a.m. and need to be escorted upstairs since she refused to carry an access card. She'd then pace the office, calling Emily and me over and over, until one of us could manage to wake up, get ready, and get to work as if a national security emergency were unfolding. I pushed against the turnstile, praying that this Monday would be the exception, that he'd just let me pass without a performance. Negative.
"Yo, tell me what you want, what you really, really want,"
he sang with his huge, toothy smile and Spanish accent. And all the pleasure of making the cabbie happy and finding out that I had arrived ahead of Miranda vanished. I was left, as I was every morning, wanting to reach across the security counter and tear the flesh from Eduardo's face. But since I was such a good sport and he was one of my only friends in the place, I weakly acquiesced. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I really, really, really want a zig-a-zig-ah. I sang meekly, in a pitiful tribute to the Spice Girls' 90s hit, and once again Eduardo grinned and buzzed me through.
Hey, don't forget, July 16th,
he called after me.
I know, July 16th,
I called back, a reference to our shared birthdays. I don't remember how or why he had discovered my birth date, but he adored that we had the same one, and for some inexplicable reason it became a part of our personal morning ritual. Every single goddamn day. There were 8 elevators on Elias Clark's side, half for floors 1 to 17, half for 17 and up. Only the first bank really mattered, since most of the big names were on the first 17 floors. They advertised their presence with illuminated panels over the elevator doors. There was a free, state-of-the-art gym on the second floor for employees, complete with a full Nautilus circuit and at least 100 Stairmasters, treadmills, and elliptical machines. The locker rooms had saunas, hot tubs, steam rooms, and attendants in maids' uniforms, and a salon of offered emergency manicures, pedicures, and facials. There was even complimentary towel service, or so I'd heard. Not only did I not have the time, the place was always too damn crowded between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. to so much as walk around. Writers and editors and sales assistants called 3 days ahead of time to book themselves into the yoga or kickboxing classes, and even then, they lost their place if they didn't get there 15 minutes in advance. Like everything else at Elias Clark, designed to make employees' lives better, it just stressed me out. I'd heard a rumor that there was a daycare center in the basement, but I didn't know anyone who actually had children, so I still wasn't entirely positive. The real action began on the third floor with the dining room. where so far Miranda had refused to eat among the peons unless she was lunching with Irv Ravitz, Elias's CEO, who liked to eat there in a show of unity with his employees.